A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 10, Being Good and Being Scientific. Can Morality Be a Science?
Can ethics be a science? What's the relationship between being ethically good and being scientific? In this lecture, I will review three attempts to do ethics scientifically. The attempts of three different modern philosophers who had one thing in common, the respect for science and the desire to do philosophy, including ethics, in a more scientific way. They are René Descartes in the 17th century, David Hume in the 18th century, and John Stuart Mill in the 19th century. Their philosophies are usually called, respectively, rationalism, empiricism, and utilitarianism. We will see how one leads to the other in a kind of logical progression. And this will set up our next lecture on Kant, who accomplished the project of a purely rational scientific ethics that Descartes first called for, if anyone ever did. Kant is probably the single most important modern ethical philosopher. But to understand him, to understand why he said what he said, you have to understand his predecessors and his problems. You have to understand the Great Conversation. Let's start back in the late Renaissance, the period where modern culture begins, the period that begins to sharply distinguish modern from medieval cultures, in fact, from all cultures before it. The Renaissance is usually divided into the earlier artistic Renaissance, the 16th century, and the scientific Renaissance, the 17th century. If there's any one feature that distinguishes modern civilization from all others most spectacularly, it's science. That's the one thing we are very good at, the one thing our culture can be very proud of. We may not be wiser or better or happier than other cultures, but we are certainly more scientific. Pure science has given us more factual knowledge, and its spin-off, technology, or applied science, has given us more power than any culture of the past ever had or even imagined having. If you were to take an average intelligent person from any pre-modern culture, say a friend and disciple of Socrates, or of Jesus, or of Thomas Aquinas, put him into a time machine and plunk him out into the 21st century in the middle of Manhattan, he would probably think he had died and gone to heaven, or hell, depending on his tastes. How could skyscrapers have gradually evolved from temples? And those handheld computers and cell phones, there must be demons in them. How could mere chunks of matter act so much like human beings? And those things flying through the air, they must be angels or gods. And then if our time traveler found out that man himself had done all this just by figuring out how to understand and manipulate matter, he would probably say that there were indeed gods in this brave new world, that men had become gods. What caused the sudden meteoric rise of modern science, the scientific renaissance, in the late 16th and early 17th century? The single word that best answers that question is method. The scientific method. Once the scientific method was discovered or invented, once it was clearly understood and used, it acted like a skeleton key, opening all the doors of all the sciences. It's not true that interest in science arose for the first time in the Renaissance. There was a lot of interest in scientific questions in the late Middle Ages. You may have been taught that medieval man was not very much interested in this physical world because they believed so strongly in the next world, in heaven, and in spiritual realities. But that is simply not true. They were fascinated with nature and very curious, like children. But they simply did not have a clear notion of the scientific method. They did physical science in ways we would call religious or poetic or philosophical. Only when they discovered the scientific method did science get provable and reliable results, as distinct from clever speculations which couldn't really be proved with certainty. Well then, if the scientific method worked so well everywhere else, if it helped us to understand and improve each of the sciences, what about ethics? Might it be possible for ethics, too, to benefit from an application of the scientific method? For in a sense, ethics is a science, for it seeks rational knowledge of something, good and evil, through causes and explanations. Of course, it's not a science in the usual, narrower, modern sense. For one thing, it's not a physical science. And for another thing, unlike all the other sciences, it's normative. It asks not just what is, but what ought to be. But as part of philosophy, it is a science in the same way philosophy is a science, in the broad, ancient sense of the word science. It studies phenomena, human behavior, and it explains and judges these phenomena by principles and laws. It's rational. It argues. It tries to prove its conclusions. So, what about using the scientific method in ethics? As we saw in a previous lecture, Machiavelli was the first to try something like this. He took his data and even his principles from his study of human history, from empirical facts. The Romans were the most successful civilization in history. Why? Machiavelli asked that question. He tried to find the causes of their success and to find universal principles that would work for any other civilization. And he also tried to do it in a purely factual way, not a normative way. The only thing he said about morality is what he thought he found by a scientific observation of the data, and that was the conclusion that it didn't work, that moralists are usually martyred, that high ideals conflict with the fact that most men are not idealists. Machiavelli's conclusions were too shocking for the rest of the world. Traditional morality was still very much in place. But so was the scientific method in the century or so after Machiavelli, when it was first shown how useful it was. Previous science had been like paper airplanes, but the new science was like a rocket ship, just taking off and leaving all previous science far behind. So it was inevitable that someone would try the experiment of using it in ethics consistently. The man who almost did it was Descartes, who was called the father of modern philosophy. Descartes lived in the early 17th century, when all the sciences were flourishing and philosophy had been declining for centuries. Ever since medieval philosophy had ended in nominalism, which denies that universals are anything objectively real, it says they're just names, nomina, and skepticism, which logically follows from nominalism. If there are no real universals, there are no universal truths to know. The most intelligent philosophers of Descartes' day, like Montaigne, were skeptics. Descartes asked himself why the sciences had progressed, but philosophy had not. He wondered how he could refute skepticism and give philosophy a new life, a new start. What was the secret of scientific progress, and why had philosophy not imitated it? His diagnosis was not that skepticism in philosophy came from its new metaphysics of nominalism. It was not that a mistake had been made in the past and had to be corrected by going back. Rather, Descartes deliberately ignored the past and looked forward. He was the first philosopher since Socrates who almost never mentioned any of his predecessors, who borrowed nothing from his predecessors, or at least claimed to. He deliberately doubted everything in all his predecessors, doubted the entire hand-me-down wisdom called tradition. And that was part of his method. To answer the skeptic, begin as a skeptic. Assume nothing. That was the first and most important step of his new method. To prove anything, assume nothing. If you begin with certainties, you will end with doubts. But if you begin with doubt, you may end with certainty. Descartes' answer to the question, what was the secret of science's progress, was the new method, the scientific method. So the obvious thing for him to try to do was to apply it to philosophy, including ethics, and that ought to give philosophy the same new start that all the other sciences had been given. So Descartes entitles his landmark book, Discourse on Method. He gives us a memorable image of the situation in his time. He says, the ancient philosophies were like magnificent temples which laud the virtues and rightly make them more beautiful than anything else, but they are built on foundations of mud and sand, for they give no tightly logical proofs and criteria for distinguishing good and evil, virtue and vice. On the other hand, he says, the new scientific method is just such a strong foundation. But on this strong, secure foundation, we have erected so far not temples, but only little workshops, what Descartes calls the mechanical arts, or what we would call technology. Now, Descartes thought technology very, very important. In fact, he bought into the whole new summum bonum, or purpose of human life, that Francis Bacon and others had announced as man's conquest of nature. But like most people, he also thought philosophy, including ethics, was very important. So the great project he called for was joining the new scientific method with the old traditional philosophical content, especially ethics. He wanted to give philosophy a shot in the arm by this new paragon of rationality, the scientific method. In terms of the image of the temple built on the sand and the little workshops built on the great foundation, Descartes called for moving the new scientific foundation under the old temple. Or to say the same thing by shifting the images, he called for moving the old ethical temples out onto the new modern scientific foundations. Now that is something like what Socrates had done back in the 5th century BC in Greece. The content of Socrates' moral teaching was not very new. In fact, I don't think there are many examples at all in the history of human thought of genuinely new moralities in content, what Nietzsche called for, a transvaluation of all values. But what was new was Socrates' method. That was so new that his contemporaries thought him dangerous for questioning everything and demanding abstract logical proofs instead of accepting the authority of concrete traditions. Well, Descartes wanted to be the new Socrates. The first thing he does in the Discourse on Method is to redefine reason more narrowly as scientific reason, and then he will try to apply the new scientific method to philosophy, especially ethics. Well, he did apply it to philosophy. He tried to anyway. He tried to do theoretical philosophy more exactly, insisting on clear and distinct ideas all the way, and beginning with universal methodic doubt, as any good scientist does. In science, an idea or a hypothesis is always treated skeptically at first, treated as guilty till proved innocent, that is, false till proved true. Accept nothing as true until proved with certainty to be true. That's the first rule of scientific thinking, and the first rule of Descartes' method. And Descartes, using this method, beginning with universal doubt, tries to prove first his own existence by the argument, I think, therefore I am, and then, in the second place, that he is a mind or soul or spirit, and then, in the third place, that there is a God. He tried to prove the existence of God from the concept of a perfect being in his mind, arguing by pure formal logic that the concept of total perfection, the concept of having all perfections, must include the perfection of existing independent of our mind. Therefore, the statement God lacks existence is self-contradictory, because it means that the being which, by definition, lacks no perfection, does lack the perfection of existing independent of our mind. That was an argument invented by St. Anselm in the 12th century, rejected by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th, and by common sense, I think, but defended by many great philosophers, including Spinoza, Leibniz, Hegel, and in our own day, Alvin Plantinga. Finally, Descartes claimed to prove the reality of the material world and the validity of our sense perceptions of it from the premise that if the instruments of knowing that we find in our very nature or essence were deceptive, then God, the author of our nature, would be a deceiver and not perfect. Now, most philosophers today believe that Descartes was a genius and that he really hit the nail on the head in focusing on method, and that his attempts to do philosophy in a more purely logical way was a very worthwhile experiment, whether successful or not. But very few philosophers today think Descartes succeeded in proving what he tried to prove. The refutation of skepticism and the proof of his own existence and his identity as a thinking mind and the existence of God and the existence of the world. But at least he tried to prove all those things. He claimed to prove all those things. But he never even claimed to extend the method to ethics. He applied his experiment of doing philosophy by the scientific method to theoretical philosophy, the issues I mentioned a moment ago, God and the self and the world and epistemology. But he never got around to practical philosophy, to ethics. He never applied his new method to ethics. In Part 3 of the Discourse on Method, he gives us a purely provisional pragmatic ethic, a way to live safely and comfortably while building the new system, like a trailer for living in while you're constructing a new skyscraper. The skyscraper was to culminate in an ethical upper story, but Descartes never got around to building that. He was too busy with physical science. He thought of himself as a scientist first and as a philosopher only second. He also died quite young, of pneumonia, in Sweden, where he had to get up very early in the morning during the cold, damp Swedish winter to give philosophy lessons to the Queen. Very smart philosophers very often make very dumb choices of lifestyle. But Descartes' successors did get around to applying science to ethics. And that is Chapter 2 in our story. Chapter 2 is a philosophy diametrically opposed to Descartes in many ways, but one that also, like Descartes, tried to be scientific and looked to science for the only reliable knowledge. The philosophy is called empiricism. It's contrasted with Descartes' rationalism. The difference is basically very simple. Human knowledge evidently has two tools, the senses and the mind. The rationalist says only the mind can be absolutely trusted, and the senses must be judged by the mind. The empiricist says that only the senses can be absolutely trusted because they alone give you the data about the objective world. So the mind must be judged by the senses, as hypotheses must be judged by the data in any science. Now, the issue between rationalism and empiricism is an issue in epistemology, that division of philosophy which studies knowing. How do we know? How does knowing work? Since reason and sensation are the two poles of our knowing, rationalism and empiricism are the two simplest contrasting epistemologies. There are also epistemologies that try to combine both poles, Aristotle's, for instance. Now, how does this apply to ethics? There were a number of empiricists who reacted against Descartes' rationalistic theories of knowledge in the 17th and 18th centuries. John Locke and later David Hume were two of them. Locke was a sort of soft empiricist, and Hume was a hard empiricist or radical empiricist. Hume insists that ideas are only less vivid copies of sense impressions, and that there is nothing in the mind that was not first in the senses. You may be wondering why we are off on this long tangent about epistemology. Isn't this supposed to be about ethics? When is he going to get to ethics? Well, I'm trying to show you why all this epistemology is crucial for modern ethics. By the time we get to Hume, ethics is in crisis, if you are an empiricist, because ethics is not about anything we can sense. Good and evil have no shape or color or size or measurable scientific qualities. If the only things we can be certain of are sense data, or more exactly, whatever can be reduced to sense data, whatever can be shown to be founded on sense data, then there's no place for a knowledge of good and evil. So how does Hume account for our ethical ideas? His answer is feeling. They are not ideas, they are feelings. Hume accounts for ethics by what would later be called the emotive theory of values. When we see a mugger kill an old lady, for instance, we think we have seen something evil. But Hume says we have not seen evil at all. All we have seen is sense impressions. An arm, a knife, a slash, a cry, a fall, a pool of blood. We call it evil, but where is the evil? We don't see it because it has no size or color, so it must be in our feelings. And unlike our sensations, our feelings are not objective and do not reveal anything in the world outside of us. But we think they do. When we see the little old lady murdered, we feel bad and mad and angry. So, according to Hume, we project our subjective feelings out onto the act, or onto the actor, the murderer, and we call the act bad, and we call the murderer bad. But, says Hume, the objective act cannot be objectively bad. It's just physical, not moral. Good and bad are not qualities of the objective world. They are qualities of our feelings. Ethics is subjective, not objective. It can never become a science. We can never have certainty about it. In fact, if we were logical, we wouldn't even argue about it, because that's just arguing about feelings, like two kids arguing about whether yogurt tastes great or yucky. Hume's empiricism, then, eliminates any possible knowledge of a real good and evil. Many philosophers were quite happy with that, with the reduction of ethics to feeling, but none of them were happy with three other conclusions that followed just as logically and just as necessarily from the same radical empiricist premise. That we must also deny the knowledge of causality, the knowledge of substances or natures or universal essences, and finally, even the knowledge of any substantial self or person or ego or I, for none of these things is derivable from sense impressions. For one thing, we do not sense the causal connection between the bird and the egg, or between the bat hitting the ball and the ball moving through the air into the outfield. We sense only the two events. So it must be only feeling or assumption or mere mental habit based on repetition, says Hume, that makes us connect them. And in the second place, we do not sense the substance or the thing or the entity that possesses all the sensible qualities that we perceive. We see the brownness of the table and we feel its hardness, but no sense senses its tableness. And third, and most disturbing of all, we never sense ourselves. We look within, and all we find are thoughts and feelings and desires and choices, but not the self that we think thinks the thoughts and feels the feelings. Not only are there no physical material substances or entities outside you, there's not even any non-physical immaterial substance or entity or mind inside you. There is no you. You are just the temporary motel where the atoms that you call your body and the thoughts and feelings that you call your soul have an affair for 70 years or so. Now, these conclusions are not ethical conclusions, but they have great relevance for ethics. For one thing, if there is no real substantial self, there can be no real locus of responsibility, no desk on which we can put the sign, "The buck stops here." And the same conclusion follows from the denial of causality. Not only can we not know that the bat caused the ball to move, we cannot know that we caused the vicious act or the virtuous act, for there is no real me, no substantial self, any more than there is any real causality. Some thinkers feel comfortable with Hume's conclusion about ethics, that it is just subjective feeling and not objective knowledge. But no one feels comfortable about Hume's conclusions about causality, substance, and self. Yet the two are in the same boat. They follow from the same premises, the same empirical, apparently scientific premises. Hume has many followers in English-speaking philosophy. His 20th century successors were called logical positivists or logical empiricists. That was a more technical and logical version of Hume's epistemology. The early classic formulation of that philosophy was A.J. Ayer's book Language, Truth, and Logic, published in 1936. Its bottom line is this: the only cognitively meaningful sentences, the only intellectually meaningful propositions, are propositions that can be known to be true or false, that is, verified or falsified. That's the first step. If a proposition cannot possibly be verified or falsified, it is not meaningful. That's the so-called verification principle. The meaning of a proposition is its mode of verification. Then comes step two in his argument. There are only two ways to verify or falsify any proposition: by formal logic or by sense observation. 2 + 2 = 4 is verifiable, and 2 + 2 = 5 is falsifiable by mathematical logic. Red shoes are red, or red X's are red, is verifiable, and red shoes are not red, or red X's are not red, is falsifiable by pure formal logic. The sky is blue today, or most spiders have 8 legs, is also verifiable, and the sky is green today, and all spiders have 10 legs, is falsifiable by sense observation. And that's it. That's all. Any proposition that is neither a logical tautology, like red shoes are red, or reducible to one, or deducible from one, or that is empirically verifiable, like the sky is blue today, must be meaningless. Hume had already said almost exactly that in distinguishing all knowledge into what he called mere relations of ideas and empirical matters of fact. Now comes the application to ethics, the conclusion from our two previous steps. It is that all ethical statements, all propositions about good and evil, right and wrong, ought and ought not, are strictly meaningless, because they are not mere logical tautologies, nor are they empirically verifiable. Murder is wrong is not a logical tautology, like murder is murder, or the color red is a color. You can't prove it by mere formal logic with no knowledge of the real world. A computer couldn't prove it. Nor is it empirically verifiable or falsifiable, like blood is red. You can't reflect photons of light or angstrom units of color from murder as you can from blood. So all ethics then becomes expressions of personal, private, subjective feelings rather than intellectual claims, rather than objectively meaningful propositions that one could argue about. They are neither true nor false. And of course, the same goes for all metaphysical propositions, all aesthetic propositions, and all religious propositions too. You probably see the connection now between this philosophy and many slogans that you've heard in our culture, which has been influenced by this philosophy. Slogans like "different strokes for different folks," or "if it feels good, do it," or "don't impose your values on me," as if values were subjective personal preferences, like a preference for yogurt instead of ice cream, or football instead of ballet. We often call them lifestyles today, as if the difference between terrorism and heroism, or adultery and fidelity, were the same kind of thing as the difference between top hats and baseball caps, or speaking with an English accent and speaking with a Brooklyn accent. Matters of style, not content, not truth or goodness. Well, there's obviously something wrong with this philosophy. Not just ethically, but logically. In fact, though it's called logical positivism, it's utterly illogical. It contradicts itself. For the statement of the theory, the statement of the philosophy, the principle that all meaningful propositions are either logical tautologies or empirically verifiable, immediately contradicts itself. Because that proposition is itself neither a logical tautology nor empirically verifiable. Its criterion for meaningful propositions is so narrow that it eliminates itself. It commits suicide. So very few philosophers today defend that early form of logical positivism or logical empiricism because it's not logical, it contradicts itself, and it's also not empirical. It contradicts empirical observation because we observe that people do argue about right and wrong, and they do so quite meaningfully. The theory does not explain the empirical data. People don't argue about subjective feelings, but they do argue about objective facts. They argue about what happened, for instance, who started a fight or whose car crashed into whose car first, and they also argue about what should have happened. For instance, did the second man have the right to hit the first man back? Or was it the fault of the first driver who stopped short, or of the second driver who crashed into him from the rear, or both, or neither? People always argue about good and evil just as they argue about any other objective facts. It may be hard to know them or to prove them, but we try, as if there is really something out there to know, something that we can be right or wrong about, something our feelings may be right or wrong about. Claiming that ethics is about our feelings is like claiming that color is about our seeing, or mathematics is about our calculating, or religion is about our believing. That's exactly backwards. What we see is color, and what we calculate is math, and what we believe is religion. And what we feel approving towards, or feel disapproving towards, or guilty about are moral good and evil. So subjective moral feelings are about objective moral facts. When I call them facts, I don't mean to imply that they can be known easily or by sense experience or by the scientific method, but only that they are not our feelings, but the things we feel about and the things we argue about. We don't argue about what is subjective. I have one dream, you have another dream. We may share our dreams, but we don't argue about them. I feel in pain, you feel pleasure, we may communicate our feelings, but we don't argue about them. But we do argue about good and evil. Is this president a good man? Was that war a just war? Is abortion always wrong? We're looking for the objective truth here, and we argue when we think we've found it, and we're trying to prove it to somebody else. That may be very hard to do. It may even be impossible to do if the skeptic is right. But the fact that everyone argues about morality seems to prove that the emotive theory is wrong, that moral values aren't subjective feelings. Even if they're unprovable moral facts, as the skeptic claims, they're moral facts. Obviously, ethics can't be science if it's not factual. It can't be any kind of science if it's only a feeling, only subjective. But if it is about objective facts, then the question opens up, what kind of a science can it be? Can it be done by anything like the modern scientific method? If so, that would be a very strong way to answer the skeptic and the subjectivist. Well, Descartes never did that. And empiricism and Hume's emotive theory of values and logical positivism says you can't do it. But a third philosophy says, yes, you can, and it's called utilitarianism. The name was invented by John Stuart Mill, the 18th century English philosopher, in his book by that title. Mill's claim is that there is a scientific criterion for good and evil. Science uses essentially two things in its method, empirical observation and mathematical measurement. So Mill observes that everyone in fact desires happiness, and he identifies happiness with pleasure. So happiness remains something empirical, something you can observe. He then gets the notion of moral responsibility from the observed fact that our choices and actions affect other people, make them more happy or less happy. We're not isolated creatures, we are social creatures. Finally, he says that happiness can be measured. It is a more or less thing. And if that's all there is to ethics, then ethics can be scientific, because all you have here is observation and measurement. So the criterion for good or evil, says Mill, is whatever causes the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people is the greatest good. An act is good insofar as it produces happiness, and bad insofar as it produces unhappiness. And good and bad are multiplied by two multipliers, the amount or intensity or quantity or quality of happiness or unhappiness, and the number of people affected. Mill's predecessor, Jeremy Bentham, had the same basic idea, but claimed that there was only a quantitative difference, not a qualitative difference, between one kind of happiness and another. There was in England a very simple children's game called Pushpin, and Bentham said, "Pushpin is as good as poetry if it makes you happy." Bentham defined happiness as mere satisfaction of any desire you happen to have. Mill thought that was too simplistic and said instead that there were higher and lower pleasures, and happiness was not quite identical with satisfaction. He said, "It is better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied." But both Bentham and Mill agreed that an act is good only because it makes people happy. So an act is good only because of its consequences. Only happiness is a good in itself, intrinsically good. Everything else is relative to happiness. So every other good is a means to this end, and the end justifies the means. There are no intrinsically good or evil acts. So if I am a sadist and you are a masochist, and torturing others makes me happy, and being tortured makes you happy, then there is absolutely nothing wrong with my torturing you. There are no moral absolutes, no moral principles. An act is justified not by its principles, but by its consequences. Philosophers call this consequentialism, as contrasted to principialism. An act is good not because it obeys a prior principle, a good law, but because it produces new good consequences. What makes it good is not a moral law, the abstract eternal principles that were there before the act, so to speak, but the concrete consequences, the amount of happiness or unhappiness that comes to be after the act, caused by the act. And this makes utilitarianism scientific because consequences can be calculated and observed, while principles cannot. If an act is to be judged as good or bad by consequences rather than principles, ethics can be scientific. The basic principle of utilitarianism is similar to the basic principle of the American philosophy called pragmatism, that the end justifies the means. There are no absolutes. Acts are to be judged by their consequences. Although American pragmatism, especially in William James, its greatest philosopher, strikes me as much broader and more humane and subtle than Mill's utilitarianism. I see at least 10 problems with utilitarian ethics. First, it breaks down in concrete situations. Its principles give you no reasons to call cannibalism wrong, for instance. Suppose there are 100 people on an island and 99 are cannibals and one is not. The most happiness that there could possibly be on that island would come about if the 99 cannibals killed the one non-cannibal and each ate 1/99th of his body. So by utilitarian principles, that would be good, not evil. You see, utilitarianism thinks only of the quantity of happiness, not of justice or rights or what is right. A second problem with utilitarianism is its subjectivism, its concept of happiness as merely subjective. In my second lecture, I pointed out that this was one of the main differences between ancient and modern thought. Even happiness was not merely subjective, but also objective to the ancients. It meant true perfection, true blessedness, and therefore it might require some suffering. Third, the utilitarian wants to avoid metaphysics and stick to scientific observation and calculation, but there is an implicit metaphysics in utilitarianism, an implicit metaphysics of materialism, in identifying happiness with pleasure. No one is a utilitarian who believes that reality is more than matter, and that man has an immortal spiritual soul, and that there exists a God. So utilitarianism is not neutral on these metaphysical questions, as science should be. Fourth, utilitarianism often criticizes traditional morality for being arrogant, for claiming to know too much, claiming to know eternal, unchangeable, universal, absolute truths about good and evil. But I think utilitarianism is more arrogant. It plays God. It claims to know the future. It will do anything if it is convinced that that will lead to greater happiness. But how can we know that? The traditional view is really the humble one, like the soldier who trusts his commanding officer and obeys his orders even though he doesn't see how that will lead to the best consequences. But suppose this soldier were a utilitarian, and he disobeyed his orders because he thought that that would eventually produce the best consequences, the most happiness. Now, suppose he's court-martialed. Would his defense be accepted? Fifth, suppose some egoist asks the question why he should be concerned with anybody else's happiness, why not just his own? And the utilitarian answers with the fact that his act affects others' happiness too. But suppose the egoist says, I know that fact, but why should I care about it? Give me a reason why I should be an altruist. I don't know what answer the utilitarian could give. His altruism is really an irrational prejudice, a relic, a hangover from traditional morality. Nietzsche pointed that out. Sixth, I don't see how utilitarianism could account for evil. Evil is reduced to wrong calculation of consequences. Moral mistakes are reduced to intellectual mistakes, miscalculations. Was Hitler's Holocaust a miscalculation? Seventh, utilitarianism doesn't meet the death test. You can't die for it. You can't die in it. No one is a utilitarian on his deathbed. It doesn't help us make sense of death. Eighth, its psychology seems too simplistic. We don't want just pleasure. We have deeper desires than utilitarianism accounts for. As Chesterton says, man's most pragmatic need is to be more than a pragmatist. Ninth, it is almost universally condemned by good people. The better you are, the less you are a utilitarian. So if utilitarianism is true, then truth and moral goodness contradict each other, because the more moral and saintly you are, the farther away you get from utilitarianism. How could moral maturity and intellectual maturity take you in opposite directions? How could the human heart be so badly designed as that? Finally, the most simple and devastating critique of all is that utilitarian ethics is not a weak ethics, it's no ethics at all. It lacks the whole ethical dimension. There's no moral laws, no moral principles, no commandments, no absolutes, no duties or obligations. It just doesn't understand what ethics is. It reduces values to facts, like reducing color to black and white. It's morally colorblind. So what becomes of the attempt to do ethics scientifically? In our next lecture, we'll look at the most ambitious attempt to do that, and probably the most successful, that of Kant, the single most influential modern ethical philosopher. Like Descartes, Kant was basically a rationalist, and he erects a system of ethics on pure reason, a system of ethics that has principles, not something like utilitarianism that lacks the whole ethical dimension, but an ethics as far removed from utilitarianism as possible. He erects a whole system of principles and obligations on pure reason, scientific reason, not metaphysical reason. Descartes tried to do that, but he never got around to it. Kant tried to supply what was missing in Descartes and thus complete the so-called Enlightenment project, which is essentially rationalism applied to all of human life. The new scientific reason now, not Socrates and Plato's old philosophical reason full of metaphysics looking for wisdom. Kant's little classic, which you should try to read for next time if you can, has the formidable sounding title of Fundamental Principles of the Metaphysics of Morals, sometimes translated as Groundwork for the Metaphysic of Morals. It and Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, or perhaps it and Plato's Republic, are probably the two major ethical classics in the entire history of philosophy. They both take ethics very seriously to begin with, and they both end with good, strong reasons for being ethical, but they're very different reasons, as we shall see next time.
This ends Lecture 10. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures that you just heard. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.